Good Friday afternoon to everybody. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Gamban and also Epic Risk Management. So I want to thank both of those phenomenal companies for spreading the word of gambling-related harm and trying to help those of us who need recovery. Enjoy this episode with Rick Benson, the founder of Algamous. Hello and welcome to All In, the Addicted Gamblers Podcast. My name is Brian and I haven't placed a bet since July of 2014. And with me today is the founder of Algamous Recovery, Rick Benson. Rick, how are you? Thanks for doing this.
I'm well, thank you, Brian. It's really good to be with you.
Thanks for reaching out. This is wonderful. I enjoyed our conversation so far, so I thought it was time we press record. Would you tell everybody about yourself and your lived experience with gambling addiction and how you came to start Algamous?
I was an addicted gambler for 12 years. It started with horses, added to it, then became heavy sports gambling. And then when I discovered Vegas, I thought that I had taught myself to become a professional blackjack player. That was a delusion. That was insanity. I actually lived in Vegas off and on for at least 5 years, and my life became a train wreck. And I finally sought help for my gambling addiction, and there was no residential gambling treatment at that time. This was mid to late 80s, other than the VA program, Brecksville, Ohio. I'm not a veteran. So I did the next best thing, which was for a month, I lived in a therapist's office, meaning I was there every day from 9 to 5, either doing groups or doing individual sessions. And then in the evenings, I was at Gamblers Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I was in the Sarasota, Florida area, and there was only one Gamblers Anonymous meeting a week when I got there within 100-mile radius. So I was filling in with AA meetings. I bought a duplex so that my father and I could live in separate units on the same property after my mom died. I'm an only child. And I started to have alcoholics new to sobriety come to me asking me if I had a room to rent. And the answer was yes. And then it was yes. And then it was yes. And then I was running an alcohol halfway house with no specific business plan. And then Arnie Wexler, my dear friend and sponsor, said, "Why don't you convert it to all gamblers? There's nothing like that in the country." And I did. And then he said, "You seem to like what you're doing. Why don't you go back and get the clinical training that you need and start to offer modestly priced residential treatment?" And I did that. And then 5 years later, we opened a program in South Carolina, second program. 3 years after that, we opened a third program, French-speaking program in Quebec. That program ran for only about 4 years. In 2007, a psychologist friend from and a business associate from Arizona who had been referring to me for years said, "We need an Algamous in Arizona." And so I moved the South Carolina program to Arizona, where we still are today. Prescott, Arizona, lovely mountain town, 12 beds. We're a gambling specific program. One of the things that we found over the years is that there's great benefit in maintaining a gambling specific environment. We have many, many gamblers come to our program who say that they went to a high quality and sometimes even posh all addictions program, and they were surrounded by crack addicts, meth addicts, and heroin addicts. And nobody understood them, and they didn't understand much about why people shot heroin in their arms. And the staff was perhaps not optimally trained about gambling addiction, and there were almost no Gamblers Anonymous meetings available, and they were told, "Well, go to AA, and when you hear the word alcohol, substitute the word gambling." I tried that.
How'd that work?
It wasn't the best solution, because a lot of the alcoholics really didn't understand. You know, I kiddingly say that it used to be, it's not so much true anymore. You go to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting, and after the meeting, everybody goes out to the bar. You go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and after the meeting, everybody goes to the poker game. Well, what does that say? It really talks about the trade of addiction, doesn't it?
We went to Big Boy after ours.
I'm sorry?
I said we went to Big Boy after our GA meetings.
Right. We know that there's a high correlation, and there's a lot of people like myself who were poly addicted addicts. You know, for some people, it's just about the gambling. For other people, it's about the disease of addiction. For me, it's about the disease of addiction. And I know about genetic predisposition because my paternal grandfather was an alcoholic who died of unaddressed alcoholism cirrhosis. My father was an alcoholic who got sober after I did. My father got sober when he was 79 years old, lived to be 92.
Wow.
If if I could say humbly, with some help from me.
You can.
And so I got the gene, you know. And I will say, however, that the toughest of all of it for me, people are surprised when I say this, the toughest of all of it for me was not the cocaine. And alcohol was not my primary drug of choice. My primary drug of choice was first marijuana and then cocaine.
And you're sober now across the board?
Sober from all of it, with one exception. Sober from all of it since 1991. However, the toughest one, which I finally put down in 2003, was the nicotine. Mm. Toughest of all of them for me.
When did you start smoking?
When I was 14.
Yeah.
I smoked 2 packs a day for 40 years. And you know what the consequence of that was? We talk about the consequences of addiction. The consequence of my smoking 2 packs a day for 40 years was I got a guy with a saw to open up my chest to have a quadruple bypass. Directly, I absolutely believe was directly related to 40 years of smoking. Because as an addiction professional, shame on me, I didn't know this. I didn't know that when you stop smoking, your lungs repair, but your heart does not.
I don't shame yourself. I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So I didn't know the damage that I was doing to my heart, although it was compounded by the fact that I had a cocaine-induced heart attack at the age of 30.
When did you take up cocaine?
It went right along with the gambling.
Really?
And the sick part of that is that after that cocaine-induced heart attack, I used cocaine for another 5 years, after the heart attack.
I had both my lungs collapse couple times on each, and I was smoking at the time, and I still smoked after like an idiot. Yeah. Thinking like, oh, it's, you know, they're repaired, they're fine, I can keep smoking. I don't smoke anymore, but that same thing.
And I had a dear friend in Gamblers Anonymous, he's just passed on in his 90s, so you may have heard of him. He's a very well-known guy in GA. His name was Max H, out of Manhattan. Terrific man, a lawyer. And I would see Max at international GA conferences, and he would say to me, because he really understood addiction, and he would say to me, so how's your recovery going, Rick? And I'd say something, you know, whatever, whatever. He said, yeah, it looks like it's going pretty good. Now you're going to go outside and smoke another cigarette, right? It really pissed me off. And he was right on the money.
That's why pissed you off, is because he was dead on.
Oh, yeah, sure. He pissed me off because he was right on the money. He was nailing it. Now you're going to go out. You got this great recovery going, Rick. Now you're going to go outside and smoke another cigarette. Really?
Can you? All right. So you're doing cocaine while you're gambling. What time frame is this?
This is in the 70s. I moved to Vegas in 78. I was there till late in 82.
I didn't run into cocaine. I did not see cocaine until I was 31 and moved to California. And I went to a party and someone just offered me some. And I said no, because I knew, knowing my gambling, I was like, no, I don't want to do that because I know that I will like that and it will make me keep doing it. How prevalent was cocaine in your gambling?
In the 70s in Chicago and in California, I had a therapist in Chicago in the mid 70s. The primary issue was I was divorcing, but we were talking about other issues as well. This was a really good therapist, a Rogerian therapist. The prevailing opinion in the 70s was that cocaine was a non-addictive drug.
No kidding.
It was a drug that you could use recreationally and not get addicted to.
That's wild. And so that was the science. And so it was like, well, hell.
Yeah, right. And I remember, I got to a place where I smoked so much marijuana. This was pre-cocaine. I smoked so much marijuana that I was building tremendous tolerance. I mean, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 joints a day. I smoked dope all day long, pretty much.
Rick, can I ask what year you were born? I'm just trying to gauge this.
1948.
48.
Yeah. So I'm about 30 years old. 20. Well, marijuana, I'm about 25 years old.
But are you someone who you either would have loved to go to Woodstock or you were at Woodstock?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wasn't there. I would have loved to have been there.
Okay. Because if I may, Rick, I'm looking at your picture on the Alchemist website, and I'm looking at you on Zoom right now, and you're wearing the same necklace and two separate, what I would describe as Hawaiian shirts, but beach shirts.
It's me.
You seem like the most relaxed man based on the necklace and the shirt. Like, you just seem like this guy gets it. You look to me like somebody who was probably into Woodstock or wanted to go to Woodstock. And so I'm just trying
to tell you category. Now, because you said that, I have to tell you about the necklace.
Okay.
Because it has significant emotional meaning to me.
It must, because you're wearing it and it's in your picture.
This is in the late 1990s, early 2000s. I treated a 60-some-year-old, absolutely lovely, spiritual, amazing Navajo woman. And she got about 5 years in recovery from gambling addiction, and she died. But when she left treatment, she gave me this necklace from the Navajo reservation in Window Rock as a thank you. And so it has tremendous emotional significance to me.
Commenting about your shirt and putting you into a category, just it helps me, like, okay, so you were of the age of Woodstock. You could go there, and you're talking about joints. And so I can kind of put you into this category.
Well, let me push you there even further. Sure. My freshman and sophomore years were at NYU in Greenwich Village, where I humorously say that I majored in drug addiction. Now, any drug that anybody put in front of me, I ate, smoked, drank. What saved me, I had a lot of roommates who were junkies. Couldn't put a needle in my arm. Not because I was afraid of the pain. That had nothing to do with it. It had to do with looking at the track marks on those guys' arms and saying, that's really disgusting. I would be defacing my body if I did that. So I wouldn't put a needle in my arm. Probably saved me from becoming a junkie.
So how does somebody who's, I mean, like you said, you're a child of addiction. You are clearly addicted across the board. How do you stop any of that, let alone all of it?
You stop because consequences become significant enough. I went to my first Gamblers Anonymous meeting. I'd already 2 years earlier filed a complete Chapter 7 bankruptcy. I'd been fired from several jobs for misappropriation of funds. That's a nice way of saying stealing.
I'm sorry, but you said 2 years earlier you filed Chapter 7 and 2 years later you went to your first GA meeting?
Right.
Wow. Okay.
Right. And so I went to my first Gamblers Anonymous meeting. And my motivation was extremely impure. I honestly believed that when I told you people, the bad guys that were after me for money that I owed the bookmakers, outfit bookmakers, that one of you nice people was going to write me a check that would partially get me out, that would get these guys off my back a little bit. You wouldn't write me a big enough check to get me even with them. That would be too much to ask. And obviously that didn't happen. But they told me they were going to take me and sit down with these guys. And I said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And they said, you are going to do that. Because you have to do that. You have to own up to what you've done. And I did. And I set up a payment plan. And they said to me, and then I was going to meetings because there was more coffee in the meetings than I had in my apartment. And there was more heat in the meetings than I had in my apartment. And you seemed like a nice bunch of people. But I didn't really think you could help me. I remember sitting in meetings and having these two 180-degree polar thoughts. And I had to get rid of both of them over a period of time. The first thought was, you know, I'm sitting here and this is a group of really very sick people. And I'm not nearly as sick as they are. What am I doing here? But the second thought was a whole lot worse. The second thought was I'm sitting here with a group of sick people. Gamblers Anonymous seems to be working for them, but I'm a whole lot sicker than they are. And so I don't think it's going to work for me. And I had to come to a place to understand that I'm just another compulsive gambler. I'm not sicker than or less sick than anybody else. Everybody has a story. You can always find a bigger story, you know?
Which, you mentioned nicotine was harder than them all, but out of the other three, drugs, alcohol, and gambling, do any stick out as harder than the other?
Yeah, gambling was very tough because gambling was predominant for me.
Okay.
I've been just as high in the inside of Vegas casino as I ever was on cocaine with no cocaine ingested. I was high. Gambling made me high. It was very juicy. It was very addictively rich.
So going back to when you were renting out rooms to alcoholics in your house, how does that go from that to let me do a gambling specific program?
Well, again, the suggestion was made to me, convert this halfway house or therapeutic community to all gamblers. And I did that. And then the suggestion was made to go back and get the clinical training. What I found, let me say it this way.
Okay.
In the first 5 years of my addiction, I bought into this paradigm, if you will, that I'm going to have to do a trade-off. I'm never again going to find anything that will get me as high as the gambling did. But if I don't gamble, I won't have to go to those low places that I had to go to in my gambling addiction. So I'm going to take that trade-off. And that was true for about 5 years. Now that's false. I have had spiritual experiences in recovery that are higher than anything that gambling ever did for me, usually about the successes of others that I may have had some small part of, some small participation in. Spiritual highs without the ingestion of any substance, without gambling anymore. So the more I got into the Alchemist concept, the richer my life became. Because I think that recovery, if you take the 12 steps of recovery and you boil it down into four phrases, it's really, here's the four phrases. Clean house, keep it clean, trust God, and help others.
Can trust God be interpreted in many different ways?
Oh, sure. Trust the universe. Trust the collective consciousness.
How did you boil it down to 4 points out of 12?
Something I heard from somebody else. Somebody said that and it resonated with me.
Isn't that all recovery? I heard it from somebody else and it made sense. It worked.
Somebody said it and I resonated to it.
Let me ask you a question, Rick, because I like what you're saying. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately, which is that nothing is ever, ever getting me back to where gambling got me. But I feel like either subconsciously or probably consciously, I'm still looking for that, though. But like, what's going to fill that void? What's going to get that? And I'm almost 7 years removed from my last bet. How do I deal with that? How do you deal with that is a better question. Or did you not?
Whether it's gambling or a substance addiction, I'm searching for something spiritual, but I've searched down the wrong path. So when I realize that recovery is about two things, it's about characterological change and it's about spiritual development, then I'm looking to be on a spiritual path. And that spiritual path, if we talk about addiction-induced insanity or gambling addiction-induced insanity, it had three component parts for me, I think for most people. One is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. You know, last 5 days at the casino were terrible. Tomorrow will be different, right? It's about self-centeredness and it's about grandiosity. So when I look at the recovery side of that, it's about do different things to get different results. Live a different life in all aspects of life, whether it's diet or reading material or meetings or whatever. Lead a different life. Become selfless, which the whole founding of Alchemist helped me to do. And third, develop some humility, because I was plenty grandiose, lacking in humility and addiction. I describe myself as an egomaniac with low self-esteem, you know, and I remember I'm referring back to this same therapist again now, terrific guy, really understood all addiction, but understood gambling addiction. He gives me this assignment. He says, you seem, every time we talk about the word humility, you seem to bristle. He said, I want you to go home tonight, look up humility in the dictionary. You're going to find about 7 definitions. Circle the one you like best and bring it back to me next session. He knew, a smart guy, he knew which one I was going to circle of the 7 definitions. Still my favorite definition of humility. Humility is the art of being teachable. It's the art of being teachable. See, I wasn't teachable in addiction. I thought I knew everything about everything and would be glad to expound for you with my great intellect. It was all bullshit.
So your ego took a blow in recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we talk about, you know, the Gamblers Anonymous literature talks about ego having to be smashed. My ego had to be smashed, yeah.
My favorite part.
And the consequences finally smashed my ego. I finally got to a place where I was able to say, my way doesn't work. You know, as Dr. Phil likes to say, how's that working for you? You know, it's not.
All right, Rick Benson. Let's talk about Alchemist for a minute.
All right.
The regular person who hears this podcast and says, wow, I have a gambling addiction. That sounds like a great facility. How does that individual go about getting into Alchemist in Arizona?
So they get to me through alchemist.com. Or they get to me through 888-ALCHEMIST, or they get to me through my cell number, which is 941-778-2496. It's 941-778-2496. And you call me, and I explain the program to you after I get your background. I'm going to find out about your gambling history, your age, your marital status, any other addiction issues, any other physical or psychological issues. I'm going to get all of that. And then I'm going to tell you that about Alchemist. So I'm going to tell you that we're a 12-bed facility located in Prescott, Arizona, that we're one of only 3 gambling-specific programs in the country, that we're asking you to make a 1-month commitment, but we're not 30 days everybody goes home now, that if you need 5 weeks or 6 weeks, you'll get that, and that usually, please hear, usually good insurance will pay for up to 6 weeks, and you'll be doing group therapy on a daily basis accompanied by some individual therapy, and you'll be living in a nicely appointed mountain lodge. And you'll be attending Gamblers Anonymous meetings most evenings of the week, either virtually.
So can we walk through and say, so somebody arrives at Alchemist, what is the day-to-day, what happens, when you get there?
And so the first thing that happens is there's a complete biopsychosocial intake that's spearheaded by our psychologist, clinical director. We're going to get as much of that as we possibly can from you. And then you're going to start doing group therapy, two groups a day, about 2 hours long each group. You're going to supplement that with individual sessions. Late afternoon, we're going to encourage you by giving you a health club membership included in your treatment fees. We're going to encourage you late afternoon to do a light to moderate workout in a really nice health club with an indoor pool where you can swim. Then you're going to have dinner and you're going to go to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in the evening as a group, accompanied by staff. Occasionally, we'll take a break. The group's been working hard for 10 days. We'll say, okay, let's take a day off and go to the Red Rocks in Sedona. Or let's take a day off and do a field trip to the Grand Canyon, all of which are within a day's round trip driving. So we do that kind of stuff as well. We do some mindfulness. We do some yoga. We do cognitive behavioral therapy. We do some 12-step work. We do some financial counseling, although we have honestly found that the best financial counselors are the senior guys in Gamblers Anonymous that we're going to refer you back to post-treatment to do what Gamblers Anonymous refers to as pressure and budget. That's more because one of the things that's necessary in order to set up a good financial plan, including restitution, one of the things that's necessary, if you don't want to just ballpark it, you need to have a job. And a lot of people come to us having lost their jobs and they're in the process of trying to get another one when they get out of treatment.
So that's when you see people is between, because I was going to ask how it's a wonderful program, but how does somebody just take a month off of work to go?
Okay. So FMLA
and still keep that quiet. Cause I'm sure people want to keep that quiet from their employer.
Well, some people need to keep that quiet, but the other issue is the other situation is that we routinely fill out FMLA paperwork. That's Family Medical Leave Act, which protects your job while you're in treatment. And if a person has short-term disability, we fill out that paperwork as well.
Okay.
So what I would say to you, Brian, if you were a potential client is, look, be absolutely as rigorously honest as you can be while protecting your job. If you can tell your direct supervisor or the human resource department you have a gambling addiction, please do. If you need to say you have an emotional problem, do that. If you need to say you have a personal problem, do that. If you need to say you need to take personal leave time, do that. Protect your job, but at the same time, we know that the whole recovery process is about the pursuit. Please hear that word. It's about the pursuit of rigorous honesty.
All right.
And I think that most employers, unless you're in a significant cash handling position, that most employers are coming to be pretty receptive to the fact that people have addiction issues. And one of the things that really played well for alchemists over the years, I find this to be kind of humorous. Now, we had homes programs in a lot of different neighborhoods. And I was concerned that we were going to get the same backlash that alcohol chemical dependency facilities get when they go into a particular neighborhood. And we didn't. The fact that there was so little known about the gambling addiction and that it's so hidden, I remember more than one neighbor saying, I don't get these guys. They just gamble too much. Why don't they just stop? It's not like they're a crack addict who's going to burglarize my home. They're just guys who gamble too much. Why don't they stop?
It's my favorite. Just stop. Just stop. Right. It's my favorite go-to in all of this. Just stop. Somebody comes into the program and everything, you know, is great. And it's time to leave the program. We did 30 days. They feel good. By the way, being away from gambling, to me, like, it's great. Everything we talk about therapy, but just being away from gambling. And you mentioned before we started talking, Rick, which was that just get away from that. There's a month.
Let's go to that for a second before we talk about the aftercare place.
Okay.
Peace. This is something that's totally baffling to me. I know of treatment centers, all addiction treatment centers, let me say it that way. I'm not referring to either of the other gambling-specific programs. That they let gamblers and drug addicts as well keep their cell phones in treatment. Are you kidding me? This guy's got his casino in his pocket.
Maybe, yeah.
His casino is in his pocket. And you're going to let him keep his casino in his pocket during treatment? Oh, no, no, no. When you get to Alchemist, you're told pre-admission that you will make a phone call home to your parents and you can pass the phone to the staff member who will verify that you've arrived safely. And then you're handing in your cell phone.
30 days without a cell phone?
I'm sorry?
I said 30 days without a cell phone?
Yeah, exactly. And I'll come to that in just a second. So you're handing in your cell phone and you're using our phone at our expense on Wednesdays and Sundays to talk with family and friends. Because I'm not letting you carry your casino in your pocket during treatment.
Yeah.
And many of the young gamblers that we're getting today, they're just as addicted to the damn cell phone as they are to the gambling.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's terrible withdrawal for them.
It's such a game changer to put. I was a casino gambler. I went to a casino. You went to the track or to the casino.
Right.
What a game changer to put it in your pocket, because we're already addicted to our phones.
Right.
And so to hear that you take away the phone, like, first of all, I'm impressed that anybody says yes to that. But I think what effect, because it seems to get pressed together today, which is technology addiction, gambling addiction, because it's on your phone, and gaming addiction. It seems like everyone's sort of pushing them together.
Right.
So to take away the phone, it makes a lot of sense, but I'm surprised you get people to do it.
Well, I mean, I'm also saying to you, don't bring anything with an internet connection. No laptop, no iPad, no tablet. Because you're not allowed to have your casino in your bedroom with you.
That makes sense. It is very jarring in today's society to think, take away your internet. Well, what do I look at? Well, you talk to everybody around you.
Right.
That would be good for all of us in our daily life. Just talk to you.
Absolutely.
To everybody a little bit more.
You take a walk on the beautiful hiking trails that surround our lodge.
You
go to the gym and work out.
I went to the West Virginia retreat, and it was 2 days away. And I had my phone, but I walked around in nature, and I just thought, this is 2 days away from gambling. And generally, if you call a hotline or a helpline and you get a meeting maybe 4 days from now, and it's a therapy, and you go, and then you go to GA. But it's still, we're talking a couple hours a day at most that you're really, unless you're very good alone, you're putting into your recovery with other people. So to have this, the inpatient treatment facility to me has always been crowned king of recovery. You have 30 days of people caring about what happens with you.
Let me reinforce that.
Please.
This happens over and over and over again, and it warms my heart every time I see it.
Good.
People 10 years in recovery, 5 years in recovery, some of their closest friendships were people that they met at Altimus. Well, of course, you're doing deep work with these people for a month. You haven't shared as that deeply with anybody in your orbit, maybe in your entire life.
Yeah.
And now you and John, even though you live in Connecticut and John lives in Chicago, John really knows you at the end of those 30 days in a way that most people don't. And you really know John. So you guys stay in touch and you become very, very good friends.
Rick, I wanted to ask you about, if you do not have insurance, what it's like to come into the Altimus program, and how would you pay for that?
So here's what it looks like. Our standard rate for a month of treatment is $16,000. That includes all food, lodging, treatment fees, health club membership. Does not include transportation to and from Prescott. However, I understand firsthand the financial plight of gamblers and their families. I'll scholarship much of that, a quarter of it, a third of it, half of it, based on our cash flow in any given month. I'll do whatever I can. When I hear you, Brian, really wanting help, then I'm going to do whatever I can possibly do to make the finances work for everybody. I can't treat you for free. I wish I could, but I'll do whatever I can. Okay. And the good news at Altimus, the only gambling specific program in the country where this is true, is we do accept most major medical insurance. Now, if you have no insurance whatsoever, you can go get some. And within 30 days, you can probably be using that insurance to come to Altimus.
Okay. And it sounds like you're willing. Like, okay, you can't afford $16,000. Let me work with you. Let me get this to a number that's manageable. Are there payment plans at all that one can do? Is that an option?
No, because we're so small. But what you can do is you can, whatever the amount that we decide on is, you can put that on, you and family members can put that on one or more credit cards and pay it off on whatever schedule you want.
Okay.
Now, people say, oh my God, $16,000.
I'm sure they do.
It's a tremendous amount of money. How much money did you lose in the last month?
No, I mean, and that's a great point. Absolutely.
How much money did you lose in the last 2 months?
In the grand scheme, $16,000 is going to prevent me from doing a lot more harm, and hopefully. And so the price.
I treat gamblers who lost that in a couple hours.
Yeah.
I treat gamblers who lost that in a day. Come on.
No, you stop gambling, money comes back. And when money comes back, you can afford things like this to help you not gamble. I'm fascinated by the idea of 24-hour care to get out of gambling.
And I have parents who balk and they say, man, I've already given him $50,000. You know, I've already given him $100,000. Why would I give him $16,000 to go to treatment? Here's my response. You gave him $50,000 in the last year. If you don't pay $16,000 now, you might give him $100,000 in the next year to bail him out of difficult situations. Because this is a progressive disorder.
Yeah.
And it's going to get worse. And if he lost $50,000 last year, you can count on the fact that he's probably going to lose more than that this year. And, well, how do I know it's going to work? Well, how did I know when I let him open up my chest and do a quadruple bypass, how did I know it was going to work? I didn't. Except the cardiovascular surgeon had a track record of success. Not 100%, but he had a track record of success. And Algamas has a track record of success. Our success rate, based on 1 year of continuous abstinence from all forms of gambling, and following that written individualized aftercare plan that we talked about before, our success rate's about 65 to 67%. I think it's as legitimately good as anybody in the country. It's a difficult addiction, but I point to the fact that our success rate is as good as it is for three reasons. One, we're gambling specific.
Yeah.
Two, we're small, so treatment's very individualized. We're not a 20-bed, 30-bed, 40-bed program where you can hide out in treatment because your parents want you to be there or your wife wants you to be there. You have to engage because we're small. And three, and perhaps most important, we've been doing it about longer than anybody. So we've learned many, many valuable lessons of experience over all the years about the best ways to treat gambling addiction.
Well, can you talk about your staff at Algamas? Who is doing the one-on-one? Who is helping? How many people do you have?
We have clinical director, who's a psychologist. We have a new MD addictionologist who will look at medication components. And there's some real nuances in that. We'll come back to that in a second. We have two very experienced gambling therapists. We have two internationally certified gambling counselors. That's what we look like. And they're the ones who are doing the group therapy and the individual therapy. Now, there is this interesting component about, and you're probably aware of this, there's some drugs out there that fuel gambling addiction.
I've heard some mentioned, including...
Okay, so there are two drugs that are dopamine agonists. They're Mirapex and Requip. They're originally used to treat Parkinson's. Now they're perhaps sometimes being overprescribed for restless leg syndrome. In some instances, they fuel gambling addiction. There's some evidence now that Abilify...
That's the one I've heard, yeah.
May have some component. And we are seeing a market increase over the last 24 months. We're seeing a significant increase in the number of Adderall gamblers using Adderall for ADHD or ADD. Adderall speed.
Yeah.
21st century cocaine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people use it, and a lot of college kids use it unprescribed. So,
yeah.
But it seems to be still given out pretty regularly.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I can't imagine gambling on Adderall. I've taken Adderall before and I've gambled
can you
before.
Imagine,
and to combine those two seems very dangerous.
Can you imagine gambling on cocaine?
I can't very well. I tried cocaine one time. Shortly after that time I told you about. I tried it one time and I was drinking already, and so I don't remember it very well. But I remember that I was hanging off the side of a car, and so I think it's probably best to not ever go back to cocaine.
So here's my level of insanity. I'm in the Vegas casinos, I don't know, 5, 6, 8, 10 hours a day, primarily playing blackjack and betting in sportsbooks. And I'm so proud of the fact that I can tell you with great deal of honesty, 100% rigorous honesty, that in all those hours in the casino, I never drank 1 ounce of their free liquor, not 1 ounce, because it would impair my judgment. However, every hour I go in the bathroom and fire cocaine and snort cocaine because it made me brilliant.
I used to not drink when I gambled either. And it was always because, well, if I drink, then I'm going to have to go to the bathroom and then I got to get up and I don't want to do any of that. So I just wouldn't, you know, once in a while I'd have a beer when I got there or something, but for the most part, no. In Vegas, I did drink because I was staying. And so I wasn't worried about driving and I didn't go to Vegas a lot. I was driving from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. So I just thought, oh, what the hell? I'm staying here. I might as well enjoy the free drink or three. But for the most part, no, because I didn't want to interfere with my gambling. Everything was gambling. This, I would buy cigarettes ahead of time. I would get cash. It was all in my pocket. So I just had to sit there. And then within an hour, it was all gone. I had to get up again and go find a means to more, which is the worst. Yeah. And then I would leave the casino, and that's right when I would be ripe for recovery and think, I need to do something about this. But then I would go home and I would fall asleep and I'd wake up and go, no, I think I can win my way out of this. That was my cycle over and over and over.
Well, I remember being so deeply in debt that I thought, there's only three alternatives here. Alternative A, I got to rob a bank, but I didn't have the nerve to do that. Alternative B, I got to turn a major drug deal to get enough money to get back in action. And while I knew how to do that, I also knew there's a very significant legal risks in so doing. Number three, I got to go back to the casino or the sports book and win my way out of this.
Amen.
Seemed to be the best alternative at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've talked on the podcast to somebody who did go with A and went with robbing banks to fund the gambling. And even he was like, I can't believe I'm robbing a bank. Like, you do it and it's done and you do it again. And God bless him. He's in recovery now. So he doesn't do that anymore. And he served his time in prison and he's out and living a good life. It's possible. That's what's crazy about all that. You think to your story earlier, if somebody just knew you as a snorting cocaine, gambling, drinking, womanizing, whatever, if that's all they knew you as, and then they see you in recovery and it's a completely different person. And that's what I feel like. I feel like a completely different person than in my mid-20s when I was gambling. Some of that
I totally identify. When I go back and tell some of my war story, as I've done with you on this podcast, I think, was I really that person? I don't identify with that person. Who the hell was that?
Yeah. And so it's you're sitting here as somebody with a gambling addiction who started Algamist. I'm always impressed with people with lived experience. And I see more of them now who want to do something to help other people who are like them, who are like this. And you did one of the ultimate acts, which was to start an inpatient treatment facility. Not everybody does that, Rick Benson. You did something very abnormal, but incredibly appreciated, because what a feat to start an inpatient treatment facility. That's incredible. So good on you. And I thank you for it.
Well, it was so good for me too. You know, I think that when I'm fully retired, one day at a time, I think there's a very, very high probability that I will not go back to gambling. But I will tell you that in the first 5 years of my recovery, Algamist was so darn reinforcing. I can't go back. I got all these guys I'm trying to help.
Yes. That's the way I feel about the podcast. I use it as accountability for my own gambling.
Yeah, sure.
I always say this is my selfish recovery program is doing the podcast. And I got to say, if your selfish recovery program is Algamist, that's really impressive.
What you're not doing is not selfish. What you're doing is not selfish. It's selfless. It's reaching out to others. It's not it's not all entrapped and encapsulated in self. It's not that.
Yeah, but also if I'm using it for me, if I'm using it not to gamble myself, it's still my little, I say it in jest a little bit. I know it's not fully, but.
But the primary motivation is not to be, for you, is not to be using it to help yourself. Your primary motivation is to be helping others, which is what recovery is all about.
And recovery is filled with people who want to help other people. As soon as people get into recovery, they're like, I want to help someone else. And I get that because it makes you feel good. And then it helps yourself help recovery. It's this really giving circle where if you give into recovery, it will give to you. And it's rewarding. You're right. It's rewarding in that way of I feel good that I'm trying to help other people like me. You know, I could have stopped long ago. And I there were times when I wanted to stop doing the podcast because, you know, it's a constant reminder of what I did for all those years. And sometimes that's not always fun to revisit. Do you run into that?
What years were you in LA and Vegas?
I moved in 2014 out to Los Angeles. And I was there for 18 months.
Where'd you live?
North Hollywood.
Was the Roxbury meeting still going on then?
I was in Burbank at a meeting.
Okay.
I think it was Burbank. Yeah, I was in a Burbank facility at that time. And it was, I'll tell you this, you might understand. I don't know, maybe. I had only known Michigan. In Michigan, I loved that meeting. I relapsed in that meeting, but I went back and it was a wonderful meeting. The people in there are the best. And I get to California and everyone in there is very nice. But I felt right back to that first meeting of I'm intimidated. I don't know what to do. And at the end of the meeting, I hadn't encountered this, but at the end of the meeting, they go around and they ask questions about what's been covered in the meeting. And so automatically I just feel on the spot and, oh my gosh, I don't remember this. And, oh, I'm not a good GA person because I don't remember that part of the book. And it made me feel uneasy. It made me feel nervous and anxious. And I mean, that was right in the midst of a relapse. So I had gambled in Arizona on my way driving to California at, I forget where, but somewhere near Flagstaff, there is a tribal casino that I stopped at. And then I stopped at Vegas on my way to California. And then I got there and I said, this is enough. I got to go to a meeting. And I did. And I went, but then continued to relapse, eventually leading into my final bet, which again, good. I'm glad it's over. But I went out there and went to a GA meeting in my first week. And I felt so uncomfortable and I just didn't mind relapsing so much. And that's, I mean, probably says stuff about me more than it says about the group. I'm sure the group is wonderful and they were all great people, but I just couldn't stop.
I was living sort of simultaneously in those 5 years between Vegas and Santa Monica.
Oh, I love Santa Monica. And if I moved back to California, I would move to Santa Monica. I don't know why. It was because I found somewhere to live online and I met wonderful people. But Santa Monica would be brilliant to go back and live in.
And the worst of my gambling addiction, I was living on the beach in Santa Monica, literally on the beach, a block and a half south of the pier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that, I mean, that's beautiful all the time.
And she went to work every day. And I went to the casino or the racetrack every day.
Oh, gosh.
And one of the sad parts of my story, I had a gambling mentor, probably also a compulsive gambler, although I don't know if he ever found recovery. We had a bad breakup over finances. And he said to me, it was good advice at the time. He said, if you're going to become a professional gambler, you're going to get on a roller coaster. It's going to have some really high highs and some really low lows. And there'll be some months when you could buy your apartment. And there'll be some months when you can't pay the rent. So here's what you need to do. You need to find a woman who goes to work every day because she'll pay the rent when you can't. She'll pay the car insurance and fill the refrigerator when you can't. And I followed his suggestion. And I love this woman. I mean, it wasn't just that. I wasn't using her. I'd already known her, but she went to work every day. She drove from Santa Monica to North Hollywood every day to go to work. And I either went to Vegas and spent 5 days in Vegas, or I went to Hollywood Park, or I went to Santa Anita. That's what I did. And I called a bookmaker every day. And she used to say to me, please, please, Rick, get a job. And my response was, don't you see what my day consists of? There's no hours in this day to work. Are you kidding me? But I can't possibly work. I've got too much going on.
Rick, could you give out the website for Algamist so everybody knows it?
www.algamist.org or .com. That's Algamus.
And we'll link it in the description so everybody can find it.
Okay.
Rick, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. And I'm
great talking to you, Brian.
The backstory of Algamist, again, like a story I didn't know. And it's really, you mentioned names that I do know. You go, Arnie said I should turn it into this. And I go, oh my gosh, Arnie was present at that West Virginia. He was on Zoom, but he was present. And so it was good to see him. And do you know Bracelet Bob?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because you mentioned the New York, you know, the older guys in New York.
Yep.
He's one, but I think he's in Florida now. And he's in
Boynton.
Yeah, he's come on.
Boynton Beach. Yeah.
Had some wonderful conversations with some really nice people. And so thank you for joining that list. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Let's stay in touch, Brian, and we'll get you out to Arizona. Let me know when you're going to visit your grandmother, and we'll definitely work it out.
She turns 100 at the beginning of the next year in January. So hopefully we'll be out there and I'll be in touch. Yeah, for sure. If I can get down there, I will. I'd love to see it in action. Rick Benson from Algamist, thank you so much. The founder of Algamist, you have a wonderful story. And thanks for doing what you did because it's helping people. It's great that you're doing something like this for people like me. And that's what I always appreciate is there's people out there helping people like me. Cool. I want to highlight them. I want to tell more people about them. So thank you so much for what you do.
And I appreciate what you're doing, Brian, because you're helping people like me. So. It's both ways.
Absolutely. Rick Benson, Algamist, thank you so much. And thanks everybody for listening.
This podcast is owned by Lee Street Media, LLC. Music provided by T Vance. Remember, this is a podcast. The views expressed on the podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests. If you need help for a gambling addiction, please seek professional help.